Welcome to The Rock Fight, where we speak our truth, slay sacred cows, and sometimes agree to disagree. This is an outdoor podcast that aims for the head. I'm Colin True, and joining me today, I don't know if he's Irish, but I want to kiss him anyway. It's Justin Houseman!
I don't know if I'm Irish either. That's one of the cool things about when you only have one parent growing up. I have no idea.
You do 23andMe. Maybe we should do that together. I've never done it.
I'm not doing it. I did Ancestry.com for a bit, but not like where you send them your, you know, DNA.
Are you afraid of the people knowing what you are?
You put that in a weird way. Do you mean like the company that holds your DNA?
Yeah, whatever.
Very clearly, it's like, oh yeah, we'll tell you all your stuff about your past, I guess. But they just want your DNA, and like what they're gonna do with it, I don't know.
All right, so we're recording this on Saturday, March 16th, the day before St. Patrick's Day. That means not only did we make it to the weekend, it is the weekend. That means it's time for America's favorite podcast segment. What is Justin doing this weekend? Presented by Long Weekend Coffee. So, Justin, what are you up to this weekend?
Before we get into that.
Yeah.
It's not St. Patrick's Day until when?
Tomorrow. Well, yesterday when this airs. It's the 17th.
Huh. My kids' preschool made them wear green on the 14th, which wasn't even the last day of the week.
You would have thought it would have been Friday. Yeah.
Interesting. I was all like, oh, I got to get them in green. I was so proud of myself. Is St. Patrick's Day always a Monday?
No, it's the 17th. It's March
17th. Always the 17th.
Always 17th.
Son of a bitch.
My buddy Eric, who listens to the show, he's a best man at my wedding. It's his birthday. That's a cool birthday. That's a good birthday, especially when you're young. It's a great birthday when you're young.
Never got into St. Patty's Day. Never cared about it. Never thought about it.
Yeah, that feels...
By the concept of having to wear green or some jerk's going to pinch you. Just never... living in a college town, too, like St. Patrick's Day is like the worst. Because just like every kid in town is just puking at 6:30 in the morning.
Yeah, right. Right.
Just like, I remember like I'd take the... I was older than most of my fellow college students, and living in SLO, I'd ride my bike or take the bus to Cal Poly to campus, and like you'd go past downtown, and they're like 8 in the morning, there'd be dudes puking up green beer downtown. You're like, God, the St. Patrick's Day, isn't it?
I put St. Pat's in there with New Year's. It's the people looking for an excuse to party. Here's another one. I don't understand staying up to midnight on New Year's. Like, why? So I can see the clock turn over?
Well, because we party every day.
That's true, we do. It's always a
party.
Do
they really dye the river green in Chicago on St. Patrick's? Is that when they
do it?
That's
true,
Did you live in Chicago?
No.
You lived everywhere else.
I did go out. I did one St. Pat's in Boston on St. Pat's. $20 minimum cover charge every bar. It's one of those I would never do it again, but I'm glad I had the experience. And I was in my 20s at the time before kids.
Imagine drinking a green beer.
I've drank green beer.
But like now.
Oh, no. That was...
Hey, put some food coloring in that, will you?
So
fucking weird.
Like, why aren't the Irish more offended?
if you grabbed clovers and just, like, mashed them up with your hands and put them in my beer, I'd probably... I'd be more inclined to drink that than, like... Couple drops of undescribable chemical in my beer, please. Thank you. My harp. I was at the store the other day. I'm like, why are they pushing harp and Guinness so hard right now? Because I don't think I've seen harp lager in a store since last St. Patrick's Day.
My best memory of a harp, there was a bar in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. They're called Molly Malone's. I'm sure it's long since gone, but they had great on like Sunday that you could go and get like steak and eggs. And we're going in there like severely hungover, getting steak and eggs and drinking a harp. And it was just magic. I'm sure it was not nearly as good as I thought it was, but at the time it was wonderful.
Things you could do to your bodies back then.
I would die. Anyway. I would do that. So what are you doing this weekend?
Did I ruin this? Well, I already had my weekend. We're recording this on a Saturday, and I kind of like I had a like yesterday. Well, actually, two things. So it's a long. They'll all kind of work together. Yesterday, I went down to Santa Cruz to pick up this new piece of gear that I'm extremely excited about. I should look up what it's called.
Are we going to review this gear on Gear and Beer here on the Rock Fight?
We sure as hell are. I need to see what the actual thing is called.
Should we have green beer when we get to this one as like the pay homage to this episode?
Yeah, we probably should. We'll ground up. We'll put some wheatgrass in it. So I went down to Santa Cruz to pick up this sleeping platform, but this super new brand called Pacific Adventure Works, and they make these. I thought it was a cot until I got down there, but it's basically like a aluminum framed sleeping platform that will fit in like virtually any vehicle if the seats fold somewhat flat. And the cool thing is that it telescopes lengthwise, and the legs telescope as well. So if you have, like, our RAV4 is a hybrid, for example, and so right behind the rear seats, if you, even if you fold the seats flat, there's like a little hump where the battery is. So like if you wanted to use this thing back there, I don't think it would.
It like levels it out basically.
Sleep in the RAV4, but yeah, it would. You just adjust the leg so that it levels out, and it weighs like 30 pounds. Mm. It rolls up. I would say the diameter is probably 8 inches, in like a big burrito, effectively. So it's really stowable and it's brilliant. Like I built out a wood platform for my Toyota Tacoma I used to have years ago, and it was kind of cool, but it was a huge pain in the ass to take it out if I didn't want it. This thing is so easy to like set up and you know, if like I have a house with a garage, so like I can just have it set up for the length of my truck and then just lift it out and just put it aside. I don't have to like roll it back up. And then when I go camping, goes right in. So anyway, I went down to pick it up, and they're in Santa Cruz, and they're right by Pleasure Point, which is like one of Santa Cruz's iconic surf zones. And I don't really go down there that much anymore. And so I got to go down there and meet with the founder, this guy named Reed, who's awesome. And it was great. Like I show up, I go in his little office thing they have at their warehouse, and there's like a copy of Adventure Journal sitting on the table.
No way. Did you do that?
He's like, no. He's like, no, I have this. I have like a Patagonia journal and this like Baja magazine that like his buddy makes, because they go to Baja and ride motorcycles. And then like, he opens the back of his Land Cruiser to show me his set. Here it is. Here's the platform. Here's what it looks like. And he's got one of our classic, the deeper you get stickers. Like,
come
stuck on.
The
side.
He's like, dude, I've been a subscriber. He's sucking up.
It was old. I looked at it. I was like, is that new? And it wasn't. And like, he's like, yeah, I've been a subscriber. And the issue was old. It was like from like,
that's awesome.
Like 3 or 4 issues old. And he's like, yeah, I've been a subscriber for like, you know, however many years you guys have been doing the magazine.
She said, take a selfie and send it to Steve.
I took a picture of the sticker and I'm like, check it out. Yeah. But that was great. And I got to surf with him and this guy Aaron who works with them. This is the thing. Like, if you don't have a lot of experience with people that own like small companies, especially like outdoor companies, it's really cool to meet these people that do this. Like this yes. guy Reed worked for like Thule as a like he ran their like test department for a long time, and then he worked at Dometic as like a I think he was like a product manager, but he's obviously got an engineering background because he designed and built this thing. And so he like quits Dometic, takes this huge leap of faith to like start this like brand because he wanted one of these sleeping platforms and there weren't any out there. And he's like, well, here's a you know hole in the market, I could fill it. And so his business partner, this guy named Aaron, is this just like the Santa Cruz surfer who works as like a pedicab. He's not really his business partner. He works for him, package it. Like if you buy one, this dude Aaron packaged it and shipped it to you.
Yeah.
He's like this Santa Cruz surfer who is a dad and he like works in the city up in San Francisco as like a pedicab driver.
Yeah.
Rider. And that like, so he goes up to the city like a bunch of times during the week to like make money. And Reed's like, nah, dude, I'll hire you. You're going to be like my number two and like, we'll see how the business goes and you'll grow with me. It's just like, it's just rad to see these like little yep. partnerships and how they work and how like much these people put into it and how much risk it is. I mean, it's a huge thing to do something like this. And I love it. And it's like, you know, you can see how much they care about the product and how much, like if something was wrong and you wrote into them and were like, yeah, one of the supports was bent. I mean, like this dude would probably drive to your house yeah. to like give you a new right. one. I mean, it's great. And like the difference between buying something from a brand like this and a brand like Thule is just, I just feel so much better about it. So anyway, I was stoked to do that. And I'm stoked to try it out this weekend. I'm going to try and grab a camping spot at the state park near my house to try it out. I'm sure it's going to work out great, but I've been looking for something like this for a while in the back of my truck. I used to sleep on a cot, which is cool, but not quite that big and kind of ungainly mm-hmm. to travel with. And this is this is a platform, so I can put stuff underneath it. And when I sleep in my truck, I have the top off, and I sleep outdoors that way. I don't, you know, so like this will fit nicely with the tailgate down. It's going to be great. So hopefully I'll get a chance to use that this weekend.
So that was your whole weekend? You crammed it into one day?
I got to surf in, got to drive like the most beautiful part of the coast, which I don't really get to do that much. Yesterday was like just one of those insane spring days in California where you realize this really is the most amazing place in the world. Just driving through like 50 miles of empty coastline, just like a perfect ocean, whales spouting and like just fun little waves.
Did you hear that? After that comment, did you hear that? That's the army of Coloradans coming for us.
No, they love. They're not leaving. Are you kidding me?
They're going to the Mag. They want to lay claim to that title.
Same about the Rockies.
What Justin is doing this weekend is presented by Long Weekend Coffee, the perfect coffee pairing for all of your outdoor adventures. Head to longweekend.coffee, shop around, add some secret handshake beans to your cart, and then at checkout, enter promo code ROCK10 to get 10% off of your first order. Long Weekend Coffee, more weekend, please. And before we get into headlines, we did launch our new segment, Gear and Beer, this past Friday. And we immediately got emails about it, which I guess we've angered the masses. We get emails fairly regularly, but like immediately, like then that morning, we got two in the general mailbox, which if you would like to write in, myrockfight@gmail.com is where to send.
It's pretty awesome, too, that they were just like, oh, it's out. Listen, like, I mean, it had been out for like an hour or two.
Yeah, no, it like immediately came in. It was crazy. That's so cool. We wanted to address them now. Figured that was the right thing to do. All right, so the first one comes in from Elizabeth. And we won't use names or where they are, but Elizabeth writes
you just used her name.
Shit, should we change her name?
I don't know. It's a weird. You just literally just said her name, and we're not going to use.
Well,
her
maybe name. Like last name. I was going to give her full. Oh, name.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. I think the first name is fine.
Is that okay? Should I change it completely?
There's a lot of there are a trillion Elizabeths in this.
That's true.
This
Elizabeth
world.
Writes. Fine.
Might not be her name. We don't know.
That's a good point. Rock fight. We create an insane amount of unnecessary stuff, and we should do our best to reduce, reuse, and recycle what we own. Also, Rock Fight, damn it, I'm going to look like that guy that bought a mountain bike 10 years ago with a mountain bike. If it's 10 years old, you look like an idiot. Huh? She added the huh. But she also added, but for real, love you all to bits and pieces. So she's kind of pointing, I think she's trying to point out some hypocrisy in the review of the Kona Unit X on Friday's
Elizabeth.
Episode.
I will say, as I listened to the episode, I did kind of wince when I heard myself say the idiot thing. But I don't mean that you're an idiot. I mean that in my own internal sort of dialogue that I would feel like if I had a 10-year-old mountain bike, because technology changes so fast or has been changing so fast in suspension mountain bikes over the last 10 years, I would feel like I was way behind the curve and antiquated and like I need a new one. I don't actually think that. But I would feel like that, I think. And so the whole point of the piece or the whole point of that episode was like, this is a timeless bike. You only need to buy it once. You can have it
right.
Forever. I mean, that it's fighting against that need to upgrade constantly. That's kind of what we were talking about as the whole reason to have that bike and why I was so stoked about it. I get what you're saying. I probably should have chosen my words a bit more carefully, but that's kind of a me thing. That's how I would feel. I would feel like I had an old bike. On a bike where the technology changes so dramatically. I'm not suggesting in any way that you buy a new bike all the time. In fact, later or previously to that comment, I talked about how bikes have become largely disposable because the technology changes so fast. And I hate that about bikes. And I don't want that about bikes. And I don't want to feel like I have a 10-year-old bike that is technologically outdated and I need a new one, which is the whole point of the Kona X, Elizabeth.
Yeah, I'm gonna defend you. I think what you're describing is kind of what, you know, the bike industry has led us all to feel. They have built up FOMO. There's become this has been going on for decades at this point, that I'll buy a carbon bike and then I'll sell it next season and get a new bike. Like, I can get a new bike every season. That is a fairly typical cadence for a lot of mountain bikers that, yeah, I think, kind of to your point, we are looking to change.
Yeah.
I mean, I think she's given us a hard time because
and I appreciate it.
Yeah, I do too. I think it's a great thing to call out. And because I think it's exactly why we need to have frank conversations around gear. Gear's not going away. We don't want it to go away. You talked about just, you know, in the last segment about the kind of small gear maker that you went to see yesterday down in Santa Cruz. Like,
yeah,
that's sort of the history. We're going to continue to make stuff, and we're going to get into it in a minute with our first headline. When we say we make too much stuff, it's because, okay, again, I talked about this before on the show. We make so much stuff in the outdoor industry that Sierra Trading Post, Sierra.com, is opening 26 new stores this year because they feel
just
like they're going
to
have enough inventory to fill it in perpetuity. They're not opening 26 satellite locations are going to close when we get through this stuff crisis. They're opening 26 new stores. So that's the stuff problem.
But also, Liz, if I may call you Liz, you know, we are not... like anybody else, we struggle with this. We're hypocrites.
Totally.
I don't know if I should probably do this for Adventure Journal too, but I used to write a column in Surfer Magazine, and one of the most popular ones I ever wrote was called, I don't remember what it was called, but it was basically about being an environmental hypocrite and how, like, in every facet of my life, for the most part, you know, we're recycling, we're donating to the Sierra Club, you know, I'm a very dedicated Leave No Trace camper and all these sorts of things. But it's like my surfboards are all made out of the most like chemically noxious, toxic shit you, the earth you could ever have, and they're never going away. And if you try to burn them, it's worse. Like, and you know, and it's just, that's how, like, you can only do so much, you know, and like, we're trying to change it, but we're also human, you know, like, you want new shiny things. You can be the most dedicated granola inhaling back to the land person on the planet, but you see that new shiny object,
it's hard to say no.
It's hard to say no. So we're doing our best here, but I want more people to write in, like, challenging us on our bullshit. If we say something that you don't like, please. I'd almost rather have that than like a gushing.
Well, that was gonna be my last point. I don't want to come off as defensive to Liz's comment. I'm gonna call her Liz as well. No. I think we've earned that in this relationship. But I think so too.
Yeah, but I think she'd appreciate
look, this
that.
Is the rock fight. We want to do better. We want to hear about it. If you don't like something, if you don't like something in the segment, myrockfight@gmail.com. These two emails were the first ones we got.
This is your show, folks. I mean, this show's for you. So help us help you.
Exactly.
Help us help ourselves.
Okay, well, our second email is from an old friend, and Tacoma Phil's back.
Not anymore.
It's been a minute. I feel like he wrote this specifically so we would read it on the show. Maybe we should just skip over it.
No, I want to hear it. I want to hear you read it.
All right. Phil starts out by writing, hilarious, with an exclamation point. You guys said you're going to do gear reviews differently, and you still fall into the common bike review tropes for rigid steel bikes. Steel is this special feeling. It's more pure. Steel smooths out the bumps. It's alive. You got to ride rigid. You become a better rider.
True.
I don't think we said that, actually. Vertically compliant. Vertically.
I don't know what that means.
I don't either. Boring. Say something interesting and true, like dropper posts are overrated and completely unnecessary. Droppers should not exist like puffin drinkware. Now, look, I don't know about the quotes. He's probably right about half those things. We probably said that during the episode. But comparing dropper posts to puffin drinkware, I draw the line there, Phil. No way.
I've never met a person who doesn't like a dropper post.
Me either.
My brother-in-law doesn't have drop. My brother-in-law is a very good, rider, but he doesn't really ride that much anymore. But he rides only single speed mountain bikes. Okay. So he's one of, which is already a very interesting subset of masochist. And he won't use a dropper post just because he's kind of like, I don't know, you know. So maybe Tacoma Phil and my brother-in-law should get together. Everybody else on the planet who has like ever experienced a dropper post is like, oh, we all need to have these forever.
I will have a single speed at some point. It might actually be my karate monkey. I will have a dropper post on that bike. So dropper posts rule.
They do rule.
How many steel bike reviews are out there? I've not seen any. Maybe there's a lot. Maybe we are just kind of retreading some old tropes.
What does he want? What do you want, Phil? Like, gosh, we tried to avoid like falling into the spec, like, you know, whatever listicle.
Yeah, I think we talked about our relationship with these bikes. Basically, what it came down to.
Are you reading other bike reviews that are comparing bikes to beers? I mean, if they're out there, I guess send them to us.
Yeah,
we're really trying to be different here, Phil.
It's good to have Phil back, though. I gotta admit.
Let's have Phil. We should have beers with Phil and talk.
All right,
about
you know what, Phil? Next, we'll have you on for the beer segment of a future episode. All right. Well, listen, everybody. If you do have comments, good, bad, or otherwise, again, it's the Rock Fight. Throw rocks at us. We want to get better. We want to do this well. We're excited about this new segment to both bring attention to the gear category in a different kind of way, but also it needs to be the best that it can be. So myrockfight@gmail.com is where to send your feedback and on anything you hear on this feed. So getting into headlines, pretty big news this week, and actually speaks a lot to what Elizabeth's talking about, to what you were talking about in your what you're doing this weekend segment about, you know, the folks in Santa Cruz, because news came out this week that Black Diamond has narrowed its focus to put climbing at the center of everything it does at the brand. And it's looking to make a reset. Black Diamond president Neil Fisk was quoted as saying the brand had become way too overextended. We are trying to do too many things, go in too many categories and with too much complexity, and it simply overwhelmed the organization. Black Diamond spent last year narrowing down the sports it serves by removing 30% of its SKUs in the equipment category, and it's planning to take out another 20% and, quote, really focus on doing fewer things, bigger and better. So an outdoor brand or any brand really, you know, stating publicly that they're going to get smaller, I feel like that alone is a big deal.
Well, I guess I wish I was more Black Diamond aware. I mean, I'm not a climber, so I don't. Frankly, I tend to ignore Black Diamond because of that. The only probably product from Black Diamond I would seek out would be, I know they make good headlamps. So I don't even know where they've extended into. So I'd be curious because, I mean, most of the time that I see Black Diamond stuff, it's very climbing oriented already. So I don't know what else, what other like worlds they've
become
foolishly.
I mean, like everything
into.
Else, right? So Black Diamond like started as with Chouinard equipment, right? That was the original mm-hmm. Chouinard equipment, which then sold off to Clear Space for Patagonia to become Patagonia, the apparel arm of that. Beattie's heritage definitely in climbing, but over the years it's become just all things outdoor, right? I mean, they make skis as well as climbing stuff, but they also make apparel.
That's
they have
right,
accessories.
That's right.
You know, and like we've talked about with other brands, when you extend into new categories, maybe even categories that on paper you're a match for your brand, it doesn't guarantee success. I mean, you know, the line balloons, you know, profitability can take, and before you know it, you're like, well, we're making all this stuff and we're making just enough money from it that the company's bigger, yeah. But profitability is not there. And I think that's kind of what they want to focus on. Let's get back to the core element about what people want from Black Diamond, and then the profitability will actually come with that.
So I've never owned a business. And so I don't exactly know what the pressures are to expand, but I still don't really understand why these brands do that. I really don't. I mean, I know some people that own small businesses like the one I just mentioned, and I actually talked to the guy that started Pacific Adventure Works. Like, what, like, do you want to grow into this big thing or do you want to just kind of stay like this, you know? And he's kind of two minds, I guess. But I have friends who own other small businesses and they're perfectly fine making a profit on what they sell and not having a staff. And just kind of, it's like their job. They just make, you know, it's like a salary you would get from any other job, you know, and like with no interest in growing. So I don't know if Black Diamond is a publicly traded company or not. I don't know if they are beholden exclusively to shareholders. I don't know if they're owned by a larger company that is publicly traded. I don't really know much about what the motivation would be to relentlessly expand. But I mean, God, if there's one criticism about capitalism, I mean, it's that, right? It's just this need, like, we're at a certain point, the products matter less than the profitability does. And so you're always trying to find new revenue streams, and all you really care about is that. It seems like a terrible road to go down to me. But I, you know, I'm not ambitious financially ambitious, shall we say. So
what you're describing is absolutely the stuff problem in the outdoor industry, right? So Black Diamond's owned by a company called Claris. I don't know if they're publicly traded or not. I think they might be. So, and I'm not even sure when they acquired Beattie, but they own them. And I mean, when a bigger entity acquires somebody else, there might be some.
They only did it to make money.
Well, that's
so
it.
Claris doesn't give a shit. Presumably, Claris does not give a shit about climbing.
Like Beattie being badass is like a side benefit, right? To the stuff that the money they think Black Diamond's going to print for them.
I'm sure if Claris thought that Black Diamond would do better by making inflatable pool toys, they would convert them to.
They'd
doing
probably
that,
be like,
so.
"Hey, have you thought about this?" And yeah. So I think that's where, again, back to the email from Elizabeth, right? It becomes this sort of thing where you now are not beholden to the people who made you cool to begin with. You're beholden to people who just want to make money, and there's a very easy look, like, oh, look, we know a lot of people who climb, they ski too. What if we made skis? What if we made the best skis that anybody is? But I mean, these are the conversations that happen.
Yeah.
And now
yeah.
All of a sudden you're making skis. I mean, this goes back, I don't know who owns Loa, but I mean, when Loa expands in the trail running, a lot of these category expansions look so simple. It's like it's such an easy jump over into something else. But before you know it, you're so far away from what you started as, and you're just pumping the shit out. And, you know, and again, it goes back to making and selling more stuff does not mean more profitability. Right. You know, it's a margin game. And if you're not hitting your margins and you end up with a lot of inventory at the end of the season or something doesn't hit, then all of a sudden now you're just overextended. And I will want to give credit to Claris here. I mean, Claris easily could have looked at if this was the situation and said, God, you guys aren't making enough money and been like, we're either going to punch you to somebody else, which is kind of what's happened to Marmot over the years. I think it's one reason why Marmot has been so diminished. Marmot was one of like the original brands with like Timberland, Patagonia, and North Face. And what they're kind of like, they're owned by Newell now, who's like owns Rubbermaid. Like, you know, so who's shepherding that brand? So Claris could have done it with BD, but they potentially obviously see the potential with a brand like BD and are allowing this to happen, which, you know, yeah, you want to celebrate it, but it's a rarity, right? Yeah. The money guy is like, it's fine. Let's step back. Let's make less money, you know, and until you can figure out how to do it.
Well, it's probably more survivable in the long run, right? Like, I mean, forgive me. Was it? I actually texted you about this yesterday, and I can't remember. Is it Kaylee or Casey? The person.
Oh, Kaylee Fretz.
Kaylee Fretz. So I mean, like his point about.
Just to clarify, too, Kaylee Fretz, who's the co-founder of the Escape Collective, who was on the show a couple of weeks ago. Sorry, keep going.
which I thought was great, about basically tailoring everything that you're doing to the subscriber and only doing it if it benefits the subscriber. To me, that's how I would think a business that's selling hard goods like BD and soft goods apparently should be operating. You know, like if you're a climber, you're a customer. Does this serve you well as a climber? And if it doesn't, we're not going to do it. Like that, that to me is how all businesses should run.
Well, the thing that this comes back to for me is this is how the industry started. The industry started on the stories like your buddy who owns Faro Wetsuits. The industry started on the guy you went and saw in Santa Cruz yesterday. Somebody had an idea. It was a solution driven. It's like, let's use this innovation or this idea to solve a problem. And the problems were abundant, right? It's like, We're talking about a generation of people. Like surfing maybe had a good from the beginning because like neoprene was an early invention in the early parts of the 20th century. Everybody else, it's like you're backpacking in like the 60s. It's like, well, I got my Wrangler jeans and my flannel on. Maybe you got a dope pair of boots, but maybe you're just wearing the shoes you wear to work every day. And so now we have textile innovations. We have all these things that are happening that allow for all these products to get created. And then, oh, look at this. Now there are applications outside of just the outdoor world. And so big companies start snapping up these brands. And there was definitely a time, probably, you know, like the mid-2000s. I mean, frankly, through the mid-20-teens, because I remember sitting with brands when I was working for Polartec who had these aspirations in their head of like, we're going to be the next billion-dollar brand. And, you know, even 10 years ago, I'm like, I don't think there's enough room for any more billion-dollar brands in this space. You just want to be a fashion brand that's sort of outdoor themed, that makes sense. Maybe you'll get there then, but now you're just playing the trend game. I'm actually writing about this for my solo episode this week. I'm taking a look at Code Epoxy. You know, Code Epoxy, product-wise, not really doing anything special, you know? And frankly, I think you could be pretty critical about some of the materials they're using and fabrics they're using, but they're kind of have come on the scene as a vibe. And it's gonna be an interesting test case about what happens to them when these sort of barred, you know, looks puffy jackets go by. Like, would you buy just a black puffy jacket from Code Epoxy, or would you go to any number of these other brands that you've known for years?
It is kind of wild that their whole thing is just that they have bright colors.
They are just, and the whole, like, do good, that's admirable. Sure. I'm not saying that's not admirable, but you're using, you know, consumerism and products to fund your doing good. Right. And I can look at Patagonia, who does something similar, and say, well, they brought us the chinchilla, right? They brought us capelline, right? They revolutionized base layer. There's a heritage there based off of the products and what it meant to the activity. That's where a lot of this stuff stems from. And I think now what hopefully the future holds is, as this shakes out, is we do have more of these sort of like boutique kind of brands who are just creating really interesting products. And your buddy, like maybe people aren't as, you know, motivated to do this by let's start a company and sell it. Maybe it's like, hey, let's start a company that makes cool stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So, hopefully.
That's my rant. I don't
know. Well, I'll pay more attention to Black Diamond now. I mean, you got my attention.
I think it's cool. I really, it's such a, you know, I did, again, the episode a week ago about, you know, the Sierra thing and opening 26 new stores. And to then have the following week be somebody publicly saying, we're going to make less stuff, and have their big, you know, corporate overlord say, it's cool that they're going to make less stuff. Mm-hmm. All right. Good on you, Black Diamond.
You have to actually make less stuff, though.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. 6 months from now, when we're covering, like, Black Diamond going out of business, maybe.
Or just, like, Black Diamond's new flip-flops. Be like, what? Wait.
We're hard pivot into Kohl's only, you know?
Inflatable pool toys.
It's possible.
We're hitting that Ross Dress for Less clearance section hard. That's where we want to get our merch.
Listen, our heritage is the Piton, the Carabiner, and the Superman inner tubes.
Toothpaste dispenser.
Yeah, All right, well, the next story is in the backcountry. We had an avalanche forecaster died in a snowslide he triggered while skiing in eastern Oregon last week.
Oh, no.
I know. Officials said Nick Burks, who was 37, and a friend, both experienced in carrying avalanche airbags and beacons, were backcountry skiing the chute on Gunsight Mountain last Wednesday near Anthony Lakes Mountain Resort. His friend skied down and watched as the avalanche was triggered and overtook Burks. Of course, all condolences to friends and families. You know, these stories are obviously very common this time of year. I only really brought it up not to be doom and gloom, but I talked a little bit about this with Patty last month when he came on to do sort of our midwinter check-in. But like, what's your line that you won't cross in the name of adventure? We've talked a little bit about this, but you're a lifelong surfer, but you've said here before you're not really willing to paddle out a pipeline, which you would think, like, you could draw a conclusion that, like, somebody with your background, that might be like a bucket list item. And you're sort of like firmly like the no thanks. You know, I started backcountry skiing when I lived in Washington. And the first time I crossed through an avalanche debris field, I was like, yeah, I'm good. I don't need to do this. Like, you know, it scared the hell out of me. And as much as I had fun doing that, I kind of just like, I don't think I want to go down this route. So like, what's that line for you?
I honestly think it, and I realize this is largely perception based, but I do think it is, will this kill me? Is there a chance that this will kill me? I think that's really
there's a chance you could have died surfing in Santa Cruz yesterday, right?
I mean, obviously that's true. But yeah. I mean, like within my normal ability levels and confidence and equipment and blah, 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 like, is there a greater than like 1% chance that this will kill me? I mean, that's honestly how I think about any of this sort of stuff. Like that's like, and so if it means scrambling on a peak, or, you know, if I'm out backpacking by myself or camping by myself, which is usually what I am doing, I rarely go with somebody else. And I think that looks like a fun scramble. Like if I'm kind of getting up there and it starts to get steep and now I'm, you know, this becomes more like climbing and a fall would be really bad. It's not worth it to me. So I don't know. That's not really a hard line, I guess, but I'm also, you know, I have kids. And so like that line is a lot closer to me than it used to be. I've never been like a particularly massive risk taker. You know, at this point now it's like my priorities are a little bit different. I mean like a sketchy wave that where it's like, you know what? I don't know if I'm ready for this right now. Like it's pretty easy for me to say, no, I don't think so. Or particularly, you know, I remember early last summer when there was still some snow around and I was trying to do one of my favorite hikes. And at a certain point, like the pitch of the slope I'm kind of, you know, zigzagging up on switchbacks gets pretty steep. And now it's mostly covered in snow and I'm just wearing regular hiking boots. And it's, you know, very apparent that a slip here would be real bad.
Right.
Like even if I didn't die immediately, I don't know how I would get out of this. And it's like, you know what? I'm good. You know, and like, I don't need to see what's around that bend, you know? So it's a good question. I mean, we all have a different one. I don't know enough about avalanche stuff to have any clue. I mean, I've been in situations where there were like, you know, I've been snowshoeing or cross-country skiing like off trail and there's like, you know, roped off areas of a hill saying, you know, avalanche danger, don't proceed. And I've seen tracks leading right out into that zone. Yeah. So, you know, yeah, it's, I don't know. We all, I don't know how to describe what the feeling is. There's just a feeling. I remember being with Stephen Casimiro in southeast Utah a few years back. And we were just kind of canyoneering and looking for Native American sites and things like that. And we were kind of exploring some granaries and some really neat, like dwellings, in these cliffs. And at one point there was like a shoulder of a big sandstone, like pinnacle that you could walk around to get to this area. And Steve leads out and I'm behind him. And then I look down and there's nothing. I mean, like it was totally walkable, but there's nothing below you. And it's like, you know, if I trip on a shoelace, I'm going to die, you know, and I'm just like, I'm going to go over here. Like, I'm going to go around. There's another trail. I'm going to just go that. And it's just like, just, you know, there's just moments where you just go, I'm not comfortable with this. So,
but there's a difference.
I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, no, but because there's a difference. Those in the moment moments, right, where you maybe are faced with a turn back versus go forward kind of debate versus the I'm going into an environment that is out of my comfort zone today. Like I know I'm headed there.
Sure.
Right.
That's different.
Yeah.
But that's different, I guess. I feel like there needs to be something that's worth it, I guess, to a certain degree. Like I'm fine with that, but I guess like, I don't know. To me, like I'm not going into a no fall zone at this point in my life.
Yeah.
Like if it's a no fall zone, I'm not interested. Like there's nothing out there for me that is, I'm going to learn or that I'm going to experience, whether it's on a trail or in the ocean or something that is going to be such a life changing moment where like, I feel like my life is less because I haven't done it. I don't think I'm going to achieve that. I don't think I'm going to find that thing.
Yeah.
And so like to me, I guess that's what I'm saying. If I perceive it as a no fall zone, I'm not doing it.
Well, I kind of look at this because we have that intention, right? But this is a good example of that, of like, here's a gentleman not that much younger than us. He's an avalanche forecaster.
Yeah.
Right. Going into a place that probably felt very comfortable going into.
Well, and I was
going to
say, he probably didn't feel like a no-fall zone.
Right.
I mean, you can, like, so I don't.
And that's what I mean.
When
isn't
I
it
fell off my bike
of,
and broke myself, I probably could have died if I hit my head wrong.
Right.
So I don't know how you, I don't know.
Well, that's kind of what I mean. Like, this is almost an example, and the tragedy aside of, like, this is almost why we go and do these things, because there is, we still embrace that little bit of, there's still always that element of risk, no matter what. Even if you go to the no-fall zone, even if you go to the place that is perceivably safer, doesn't mean that something won't happen there, too. And that's kind of why we do these things, right?
See, I disagree, or at least personally. I obviously, that's a big trope in the adventure community.
Yeah.
And I like, you know, people will ask, how do you define adventure? And to me, it's not about risk, at least not in the way I perceive it. Like, I don't get a thrill from risk. I get a thrill from doing something I haven't done before or seeing something I haven't seen before.
Mm-hmm.
But, and it could just be my own comfort level with certain feelings, you know, whatever, like your own personal neuroses or anxieties. But to me, I don't enjoy the feeling of like, oh, this is risky. Like, I'm on a tightrope. Like, that's not something I would ever purposely do. So, you know, like, I like to go super deep into the backcountry and go fishing and go climbing or hiking and go ride bikes. Not because if something goes wrong, I get there's a little thrill that, oh, what if it goes wrong? It's just because those are cool places to be.
Yeah.
And like, I like surfing waves that some people might find challenging, but plenty of people wouldn't. Not because it's a thrill challenge to like overcome something, just because that's a cool wave to ride, you know, and like feel that way, or like mountain biking. Like, this is a fun line to ride down. I'm not thinking like, oh, this is like out of my comfort zone and this is a risk and a thrill and that's the adventure. That's not where adventure is for me. I do understand, like, Casimir would disagree. Like, his whole thing is like, adventure needs a risk. If there's no risk, it's not an adventure.
Yeah, I've heard him say that too.
And like, I don't agree. I mean, like, maybe, you know, it's hard to have an adventure if there aren't elements that make you uncomfortable, I guess. But again, to me, I view these sorts of things as like, to me, it's an adventure if I'm learning something new or doing something different or seeing something I don't usually see. I don't know what the outcome will be, I guess.
It is a bit of a fine.
But that doesn't mean, I don't mean I'm going to die. I mean, the outcome might be, this isn't fun, or this was way harder than I thought, or I don't know what I'm going to see. Like that's how I think about it. Like, I don't know the outcome, but I'm not thinking of it as in, I don't know if I'm going to be okay. My outcome, it's like, I literally don't know what will happen.
Yeah.
That's why it's an adventure.
Yeah, no, it's a fine line, right? Because there are the people who are obviously risk pursuant, maybe is the word. The people
sure.
who are like it says, what's the avalanche forecast today? Oh, it's blazing red. Nah, I'm gonna go for it anyway, right? And it's like, there are those, or I'm my level of surfing, not your level, and I'm happen to be on the North Shore of Oahu. Like, fuck it, I'll paddle out and see what happens. Right?
Plenty of people do that.
Lots of people do that. I also think though that the element, you know, then you can get into the game of, if there's no risk, then it's like, well, why don't you just sit on the couch and like watch movies all day too, right? Because there is the, oh, I negotiated that rock wrong and now I'm down, you know, bleeding on the side of the trail, right? I mean, there is an element of that. I do feel, to Steve's point, I think it's important, but I also agree with you that like, that's kind of how I approach it too. I think you and I are both saying that we actually like climbing on mountain bikes compared to most people who prefer the downhill. And part of that is same as you, I've never felt comfortable going downhill. I was a nightmare when I was doing mountain bike races. I probably told you this before, where I would be I was a really strong climber and I would pass people on the uphills. But then on the downhills, I'm like an old lady out there, like pumping my brakes, and people are, you know, all these people I just passed now are like, get out of the way. And then it would repeat on the other side, because I think I felt like I still had my mom's voice in the back of my head going, you're going to hurt yourself. You know? So it's a weird thing. And I just kind of, some of it though, like, it just made me kind of reflect on that with this story of like, here's someone who was skilled, knew by exactly where to go on a given day, and the bad thing still happened. Right. I think maybe, you know, I look at the way you described it too, like maybe Aaron Ralston is the best example of this, of like what he was doing the day he got caught. That'd probably be something I could see myself doing if I knew the terrain where I was going. And the only mistake he made that time was he didn't leave a note of where he was.
The Aaron Ralston.
Yeah, the guy who got crap had to cut his arm off. Right. Yeah. It just, the bad thing happened in a place where 9 times out of 10, he just goes to that canyon and drives home.
It just shows you how gnarly avalanches are. I mean, I don't know how many times you have to hear about
scariest thing that can happen outside.
About an avalanche expert getting killed in an avalanche. I mean, it just seems like that happens a lot.
Yeah.
Maybe it doesn't, but you hear about it enough, you know? And so, I mean, again, I forget his name. but like he may have felt perfectly comfortable. Nick Burks. probably wouldn't have been there had he thought there was a danger.
Right. That's what so I mean. Usually these stories are like the person who's like, what are you doing? Why were you there? And this one kind of made me a little more reflective on it. I mean,
nobody goes out there to die on purpose, obviously. You know? So, yeah. Well, probably do. Some people do, I guess.
All right, so let's not end with tragedy. Let's end with something upbeat, the, kind of the story of the week, which was last week, solo sailor Cole Brower has become the first American woman to race solo, nonstop, and unassisted around the world. This came out right before we recorded last week, so we didn't get to it then. We're excited to talk about it now, though. She finished the Global Solo Challenge on March 7th, finishing second overall, and at just 29 years old, Brower was both the youngest skipper and the only female sailor in a field of 16 boats. I don't know if there's a more impressive feat than when you hear about someone sailing around the world solo. I mean, it always, and I think that's probably universally kind of known because anytime it happens, usually it's in the news, like so-and-so right. just did this. Right. And this one, not only that, is also hugely important. So what did you think when you heard the news about this?
I mean, same thing. We've talked about this before, right? I think open ocean sailing is probably the most badass thing you can do. I mean, there's
hands down.
Even with a crew, mm-hmm. but like solo. Wow. Her boat was 40 feet, which is pretty decent sized. Like, that's not tiny. That's actually a pretty good sized boat. Like, my wife's parents have a 26-foot, Ranger, which is a single mast. Yeah, of course it's a single mast, sailboat. And like, that's like, you know, you're like, oh yeah, I could like spend a weekend on this, you know, so a 40-foot boat's not small, but, I'm trying to think, I think it took her like 130 days. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I unsupported, I assume that means she's at no point had contact with anybody else. I mean, even just doing that is pretty gnarly.
It's crazy.
I mean, just sitting in a field or whatever, with like, or being a lighthouse keeper, or not seeing another human being for 130 days is pretty gnarly. I can't even fathom the storms that she dealt with. I can't imagine. And she had some pretty rough moments. She's a great Instagram follow because, like, she would upload stuff. You know, she must have had Starlink or something. She would upload stuff constantly to Instagram from the boat. And it was amazing because she's just like watching Netflix or like having little dance parties. And sometimes in the background of her dance party, there's just like a hellacious maelstrom like brewing. And she's just on the deck, like, you know, dealing with the sail with headphones on, just dancing. And you're just like, this woman is incredible. And I read a little bit about her story. She tried out for another race, or tried to get involved in another race like a couple years before, and they were all like, "No, you're like a tiny woman. You can't do this. Like, you're not like a big burly macho sailing man." And like most, you know, I'm sure how many of those people did this? Probably not any, you know. Just it was just a remarkable thing to have done. And she didn't learn to sail till college.
Oh,
she's
really?
I'm pretty sure she's from Long Island or Long Beach, New York.
I didn't know that.
And she went to University of Hawaii, and she learned how to sail there. So, I mean, maybe a decade, you know, of sailing experience.
I think this probably gets overused in the adventure community, but like people who do this, like I read Liz Clark's book Swell about, people who aim for either achievements like this or lifestyles like this, they truly are cut from a different cloth.
Absolutely. I mean, that is an adventure.
Yes.
Right. Like me going, you know, backpacking is sure, but right. That's an adventure.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't like, wow. Like of all the things you could possibly see, if you've never been on the open ocean where you can't see land, it's a pretty spectacular experience. And I don't care what kind of boat you're on. I mean, lamely, I've only done that on a cruise ship, but like where you can't see land at all,
yeah.
and like spend an entire day at sea where you can't see land, even just that with like a mall below you, you know, is still pretty wild.
Right.
Like if you're just up on deck. So the evenings that she must have had just like on the deck, thousands of miles from land,
but no light pollution, just
heaving seas or calm seas, you know, just like, oh my God, what an experience. I mean, that to me, nothing is more impressive. There's nothing more impressive.
There's nothing in me that wants to do something like that, but it simultaneously I'm jealous too. You know what I mean? Like
I feel like she's probably had, like she probably has had some kind of experiences.
Yeah.
That's the thing, I guess. Like I don't necessarily envy like Cody Tonzin. Like I don't ski and like, I see your like giant big mountain things. That's cool. I don't really have a burning. I don't feel like I'm missing out. I don't feel like I'm missing out when I talk to big wave surfers about surfing Jaws and Waimea. I mean, I know what it feels like to ride a wave. I don't know what it feels like to ride a 40-foot wave. I don't feel like I'm missing out that much. Something like this, like where you really have to dig so deep and experience something that very few people will ever experience.
Yeah.
To me is pretty special. So I think like 100, and I wrote a little bit about this for AJ. I think there's only been like 186 people that we've known of that have sailed around the world solo. That's it. Out of the, what, how many billions of people have lived on this planet?
I mean, like, was that, it 9,000 have made it to the top of Everest or whatever it is,
yeah,
you know?
So it's just like, it's a, that's an, that's what, a, what an accomplishment. I
congratulations.
I'm going for a trail run today and I'll feel like it though, somehow, you know, like I really adventure today. I went for a trail run that was 2 miles longer than normal.
I'm going to go for a bike ride when I'm done with this. You know, I'm going to, it's going to be, I'm going to sweat a little.
Yeah.
It's
so soft.
Well, no, I think you're right. Cole Brower, cut from a different cloth. Congratulations to her. It's exciting stuff. We can wrap it up there, man. Anything you want? Well, first of all, I guess we should promote Gear and Beer, which is our new weekly Gear and Beer segment. It comes out every Friday. Secondly, this is coming out on Monday, the same day your conversation with Cody Townsend over on the Adventure Journal podcast. Mm-hmm. You're big time over there. Big time and over there.
Well, you know, I have the connections.
Word is he reached out and said, I want to talk to Hausman.
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
That's true, actually. Mm-hmm. I was like, fine, I heard it enough. I'm like, all right, fine.
It's like, it was like I'll a year or something. It's just like every, another email.
It was a good convo. I would rather have just talked to him about surfing the whole time than skiing, because he clearly wanted to talk more about surf, which was fun. But he has some big, I don't know. I think he maybe makes a big announcement on the show. I can't quite remember, but, well, not really. Like the 50s winding down. Like, I think the last episode is next week.
Really?
That they're ever going to make. Yeah. And he talks about that be on the show. So if you're a big fan of the 50, you'll definitely want to listen
to it. I'm definitely a big fan of the 50.
And you should be a big fan of the 50, because it's easily one of the coolest things anybody has put out outdoor media in a long time. Very, very cool. And Cody is an awesome guy. Like, really, he's exactly what you would think from watching the show. Super humble, super on it. He's a pro. I wish I was like buddies with him. He's a good dude.
There you go.
It must be so nice to have someone look at you and go, that's an impressive human being. No one's ever said that about me.
Justin, you're an impressive human being.
Well, there it is. First time. Thanks, Colin. I wish I could say the same. Just kidding. You're very impressive.
Thanks, buddy. All right, that's the show for today. But before you move on to that next podcast, could you take a hot second and give The Rock Fight a 5-star rating wherever you are listening? Maybe leave us a review. You could write something like, this show is awesome. Colin and Justin should rule the world. This actually worked one other time that I told someone to write that and they wrote it in the review. So please, someone do that. That'd be hilarious. The Rock Fight is a production of Rock Fight LLC. For Justin Hausman, I'm Colin Truth. Thanks for listening. Here to take us out, he's saying goodbye in gasoline the only way he knows how. It's Krista Makes with the Rock Fight Fight Song. We'll see you next time, Rock Fighters. Rock Fight.